Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So like I was saying earlier, that we will alternate the Dhamma talk with the sutta study. As the rains is progressing to the second half, gives us more time for seclusion and group meditation. Okay, so this is the Maha Asapura Sutta, which is the greater discourse on Asapura. Before we start, any questions? Some people ready already? More or less? Okay, I'm just going to read the bits that I find interesting, and then if you have any questions, you can raise it at the end of the class. I also bring in a few other, and it's basically on the gradual training of the Buddha, where he spoke about, you know, many, many different ways. And it starts off, okay. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Angan country, at a town of Angans named Asapura. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. Recluses, bhikkhus. That is how people perceive you. And when you are asked, what are you? You claim that you are recluses. Since that is what you are designated and what you claim to be, you should train thus. We will undertake to practice and practice those things that make one a recluse, that make one a Brahmin, so that our designations may be true and our claims genuine, and so that the services of those whose robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites we use shall bring them great fruit and benefit, and so that our going forth shall not be in vain, but fruitful and fertile. So that's a pretty important first paragraph. I think the word in the Pali word, the recluses, is a summoner, a one gone forth. And you can see that the Buddha, you know, redefines, a recluse. It's not just a person who's wearing a robe. There's things to be done. You know, there's a training, right? And also, he also redefined a Brahmin. Usually at the time of the Buddha, a Brahmin is somebody, you know, a caste. You get born into it. But here, the Buddha, you know, kind of, redefined what a true Brahmin is, and what a true samana, a one who's gone forth is. And we'll see later what it means. But also, he says, see, there's a training. It's not something, you know, just because we put on the robe that the work is done. Now, once you go forth, while you take the ordination, that's just the beginning of the path. There's much work to be done. And he will go through the gradual training. And also, you know, like as I was saying earlier in the Dhamma talks, that, even though our livelihood is based on the generosity of the lay people, there is an inherent karmic debt that we owe. Right? So remember, so that the services of those people who receive the robes, alms, food, that we use, bring them great fruit and benefit. So we should, make use of the things we're offered in a good way by putting forth effort, by training our mind, by hopefully attaining one of the superhuman states. And also for our own benefit, so their own going forth is not in vain, but fruitful and fertile. Right? So those are the things to keep in mind. Okay, so and of course, it's gradual training. So it always starts, and this is from the Theravada tradition, going back to the words of the Buddha, always starts in morality, ethical conduct. There's no shortcut. You don't go straight to wisdom. You don't go straight to samadhi. You have to establish the foundations, like building a house. You have to make sure the concrete, the foundation's in place before you rush. So if you start with the ceiling, you'll find that your building will crumble very quickly. So start off with, Buddha said, and what bhikkhus are the things that make one a recluse, that make one a Brahmin, bhikkhus? You should train this. We will be possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. No, bhikkhus, you may think this. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. That much is enough. That much has been done. The goal of recluseship has been reached. There's nothing more for us to do. And you may rest content with that much. Bhikkhus, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse status do not fall short of the goal of recluseship. Well, there's still more to be done. And first is this idea of fear and shame. Shame and fear of wrongdoing. And it's this Pali that was explained as hiri otapa. It's, you know, shame might be have this kind of Christian connotation of guilt and stuff. But I think from a Buddhist perspective, it's more like a internal moral compass. We have a conscience. You know, when we do something or about to do something, we understand that, you know, whether it is wholesome or unwholesome. And all of us have that moral compass inside. And we think we're just about to do something unwholesome. Then we refrain from doing that. You know, this kind of, you know, shame and fear of wrongdoing. It's the thing that knows that, you know, that we are better than this. We don't have to take what's not, what doesn't belong to us. You know, we don't have to lie. We don't have to misuse our sexuality in a way that harm ourselves and hurt others. Right? So that's the first, you know, the starting point of training, is this kind of internal moral compass of knowing, you know, what is right and what is wrong. What bring yourself harm and others harm. And then, of course, that's at the beginning. He goes on to elaborate on, first, the next is the bodily conduct. Our bodily conduct should be purified, clear and open, flawless and restrained. And we will not laud ourselves and disparage others on account of that purified bodily conduct. Right? So it's always, you know, doing things in a wholesome way. Started with bodily, verbal, and mental. And also, the last bit is also interesting, that just because we have pure bodily conduct, that we don't look down on others who haven't perfected that already. Right? So this kind of pride and conceit is also an obstacle to the training of the mind. Whatever wholesome states we might have achieved, it's not on the account of that, that we put ourselves above others. So he goes through that. Yeah, bodily, verbal, mental. So those are the kind of the ethical moral conduct to start out with. Blah, blah, blah. And then next, once you've done that, next is the livelihood. Our livelihood should be purified, clear and open, flawless and restrained. That's the thing. This idea, being a monk, a samana, one who's gone forth, being clear and open. We don't sneak around. We don't say, okay, there's 8 precepts. Of course, we have this trust system in the monastery, you know, but we don't try to sneak into the kitchen without no one's looking, eating. This is an idea of, you know, whatever we do is on the open. When there's rules, we try to follow it. We don't try to kind of hide things and act in, you know, in different times just because people aren't around to look at us. And that's the idea of mostly it's a self-training. Obviously, I'm not going to be checking on you whether you're eating in your room or whatever. That's, you know, your own kind of moral precept to keep. Okay, and the livelihood. Obviously, there's a fair amount of people here who are living the lay life. So the right livelihood for a lay person is pretty straightforward. Is not to be trading, or be involved in not to be a butcher, obviously, and not to be selling or trading in weapons, poison, liquor, or human beings. So those are the right livelihood for a layperson. For a monk, I think the right livelihood for a monk is generally defined as not to get involved in fortune-telling, telling people the right dates, not to be involved in matchmaking, running errands for lay people, selling, buying things, obviously not using money in any kind of form, and not to hint for things, not to try to, things that, you know, try to get things that are, is not conducive to the holy life. Not to got to get expensive, luxurious items, nice watches or cars or whatever. So that's the right livelihood for a monastic. So once you have that kind of sorted out, the ethical conduct, you know, bodily, verbal, and mental, right livelihood, then there's more to be done, Buddha said, obviously. What more is to be done? Well, bhikkhus, you should train this. We will guard the doors of our sense faculties. On seeing a form with the eye, we will not grasp at its signs and features. Since we left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief may invade us. We will practice the way of its restraint. We will guard the eye faculty. We will undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. So that's the thing, you know, our faculty, sensing. From the West, there's kind of an encouragement to experience, to see. The more you see, the better you'll be, the better person. You can't die unless you've seen the sunset over Paris in springtime or something. You have to do all these things. But actually in the Buddhist time, it's just the opposite. To always guard our five sense faculties, or six sense faculties. The eye, ear, nose, tongue, the body, and the mind. Just to make sure that the mind doesn't veer off. And whatever we experience, pleasant or unpleasant, that we don't get attached or get carried away with it. When you have a feeling, you know that feeling comes and goes. Don't just say, whoa, is it a sign of something? I feel something. Try to, just to know, is it rising? It's present, and it's passing away. Just that much. And not to get lost. Because sometimes we do get, a lot of time, maybe we say, okay, when I see things, I'm not attached to seeing things or hearing things, smelling. We get touched away with taste of food, pleasant, unpleasant, it's just food. And when you contemplate closely, chew, 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 you swallow, and that's it. It's a couple of seconds, really. The rest of it is memories, proliferations, fantasy, whatever we make of it. So it's just to focus and to contemplate all these sense faculties that we have. But how much happiness there is in them. How quickly it passes. It doesn't last that long, actually. And same with the mind. Sometimes we get stuck in a certain idea and we go on, we think about it. Just to know, okay, it's just a thought in the mind. It arises, stays a while, and passes away. And just stay with that. And not to allow the mind to be consumed with many things. And that's the thing to be aware of. Because during the rains, there's not a whole lot to be doing. Encourage us to really spend time by yourself. Not too much reading. And so there's the mind, if you've been very active in the lay world, you come here, the mind is not going to want to be not doing anything. It's used to, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, contacting people, communicating. Then it'll start to fantasize. It'll start to make things up. So just to watch that as well. Sometimes the mind will kind of bring its own things. So just be aware that, in the adjustment periods, when you come to a monastery, things are very quiet, to see what things come up in the mind when you're trying to meditate. Because if you're very used to a fast-paced, highly interactive lifestyle, then the mind will take a while to calm down. And just to allow for that, to realize, to expect it, that the mind is not going to want to calm down. It's going to want to drag things up, remember, relive your experiences when you're trying to meditate. But just to watch, to embrace, to make peace with it, and then to let it go. Just that much, Ajahn Chah would say. Not make more of it, not make less, not try to suppress it. Because it just, stays there and it comes up again. Just to be with it, to watch it stay and watch it go away. So that's the restraint of the sense faculties. And it's not an easy thing for most of us, because we're always told to experience more, to do more, to feel more, to think more, to have lots of opinions and views about this and that and the other stuff. But that just adds to the confusion and distractions. Remember, peace is good. Not having strong views one way or the other. Not having strong feelings one way or the other. Sometimes we're quite attached to our feeling. Feeling of happiness. We're happy, really, really, really happy. We think everything's wonderful. We love this place. We love everything about it. And then we have a bad day. And we get really depressed. We get self-doubt plague us. Then we want to run away and do something else. Just know these are just feelings. They come and they go. Not a big deal. And like Lumpa Lin was saying the other day, and they're not our feelings. They come based on a cause. They'll stay for a while and they'll leave when it's ready to leave. Not yours, not me, not mine, not ourself. So just reminding ourselves this. Obviously, we don't have perfect mindfulness. Sometimes we lose it. But just remind, it's just feeling. Not me, not mine, not a self. This is unpleasant feeling arising. Just that much. Once we restrain the sense. Next is moderation eating. You should train this. We will be moderate in eating. Reflecting. This is reflecting that we do with in the monk's room. It's a slightly different with Bhikkhu Bodhi, but basically, you know, wisely reflecting. Use alms food, not for fun, not for pleasure, not for fattening, not for beautification, only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, for keeping it healthy, and also for helping with the holy life. Thinking thus, I will lay hunger without overeating, so that I can live blamelessly and at peace. So basically, you know, looking at food is something that we have to make use of. Obviously, we cannot we cannot sustain the holy life or the practice without eating. We know, you know, moderation. Like Ajahn Chah was saying, it's easy to eat a lot. Obviously, just, you know, let go and just feast because you only eat once a day. So, it's, you know, sometimes it's easy just to, you know, to go for it. And then we feel guilty and we flip to the other side. We start fasting. No, I'm going to fast for 3 days. I think I've been such a pig for the last week, so I'll fast. And then we go to the other extreme. We don't eat. And but Ajahn Chah said, you know, it's easy to eat a lot. It's also easy not to eat. But it's much harder to eat just enough. To always figure out, you know, what do I need today? You're working hard, digging, chopping wood. Yeah, then eat more. Obviously, if you're not eating, and you're not doing so much physical work or sitting and walking, then, you know, kind of moderate the amount. And that takes more mindfulness. It takes more sensitivity to know what the body needs. And that's what the training is about, just to know what's happening in the present moment, what's happening today. Not what you think, not what you plan, but what actually is happening. And to have the sensitivity to know, okay, yeah, I think I've had enough. Yeah. So it's always a constant, it's a practice. You know, since we eat every day, it's a great opportunity to practice every single day. You know, did I get that right? Did I get that wrong? And in any case, not the end of the world, it's always tomorrow to work on your eating practice. Done that. And then next is wakefulness. What is more to be done? Bhikkhus, you should train this. We will be devoted to wakefulness during the day while walking back and forth and sitting. We will purify our minds of obstructive states. So that's during the day. Then the first watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, will purify our minds of obstructive states. And the Buddhist time, the first watch of the night is from 6 to 10. Okay, so 6 to 10, sitting, walking, and always purifying our mind of, you know, greed, anger, or delusion. And then the middle watch of the night, we will lie down on the right side in the lion's pose, with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in our minds the time for rising. So that's a good practice also I encourage people to do. When you go to sleep, before you go to sleep, try to have a focus on what time you think you should get up. Whatever amount of sleep you think you is enough. I don't know, 6, 5, 7, 8, 10. Just to say, okay, I'm going to wake up 5 and see what that does. See how close you are. And the middle watch of the night, and this is where you get the 4 hours of ideal from. It is from the suttas, that's why. It's 10, the middle watch is 10 to 2 in the morning. So that's when the Buddha, and that's why it's in the scripture, that's why you see some monks do that. They, when they go to sleep, they lie on the right hand, right side. One foot on the other. Just a way of mindfulness. So when you move, you shift around, you know that you're doing that. So from 10 to 2, you rest. And then the third watch of the night, which is from 2 to 6, you wake up and you continue walking and sitting and just purifying the mind. And that is a practice of wakefulness. So that's what you see the 4 hours. And I think Generally, it is on the, you know, I think it's not as much as 8 hours, just what we medically program to think that we need. Everybody tells you that. But I think if your meditation is going well, you're doing mostly sitting, walking, you're staying in a kind of a meditation center or monastery, 4 or 5 hours, not unreasonable. It's not too low. And also in the monastery, you can always take a nap in the afternoon if, you know, wake up too early or whatever. So the thing is also to, you know, with the same as eating, to know what your body needs, what's good for it. And not too much, not too little, but also, you know, just right. You know, where you are in your kind of health, you're sick or getting older or getting over cold, you just eat more. But not to waste your time. I think someone said, if you sleep 1 hour less, then you live for 80 years, you actually have an extra 5 years or something to do your practice. That's just 1 hour less. But anyway, moving on to after wakefulness, still not, obviously not you, there's still more to do. You seek the requisite status. Next is mindfulness and full awareness. We'll possess the mindfulness and full awareness. We'll act in full awareness when going forward and returning. We'll act in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, flexing and extending our limbs, wearing our robes, carrying our outer robe and bowl, eating, drinking, consuming food, tasting, defecating, urinating, walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. So in that, okay, so do all that practice as well. And that's the thing, interesting. Mindfulness and full awareness usually goes after sense restraint. It's only when we restrain our senses that we have enough energy to really focus on the other stuff, that the mind starts to brighten. If we continue talking, stimulating our senses, you know, reading, magazine, music, or whatever, most of the mind, that's what you see, and that's why it's so hard to practice when you live out in the world. Because we are so always out there, our sense factor is so distracted, there's not much energy left to focus, to be mindful. So the practice of mindfulness and full awareness, you know, only comes about once we kind of restrain the senses. Once we kind of don't waste the energy of the mind by going outwards and processing all the information, interaction, but staying inside and staying protected. And after we do that, we strive to abandon the five hindrances. And that you need bhikkhus resort to a secluded resting place, forest, shoot, root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, jungle thicket, open space, a heap of straw. Here, your kuti is good enough. Kuti or cabin, wherever you're staying. It's a quiet place. On returning from his arms round, after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect and establishing mindfulness before him. And then he abandons the covetousness for the world. Covetousness, in other words, like yearning, I think, yearning interest. Covetousness is a bit of an awkward word, no one knows what it means. I think what I interpret is kind of yearning, wanting to go out, interest in the world. Also abandon ill will, irritation, hatred. You know, you have an argument with somebody, just gonna let all those things go, any irritation you might have acquired, accumulated from the kitchen work or working with others, try to leave those alone, abandon that. And these are the five hindrances, obviously. Sloth and torpor. Abandon sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor. Recipient of light, mindfully, fully aware. He purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. And then you abandon restlessness and remorse. He abides unagitated with the mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. He abandons doubt. He abides having gone beyond doubt. That's the last hindrance. Unperplexed about wholesome states, he purifies his mind from doubt. Okay, so that, like I said, that's the five hindrances before you can do anything. And that's the crucial step to any deep meditation. These are the five obstacles to meditation that I spoke about a few weeks ago. And it's a nice paragraph when the Buddha describes the states when you are free from the five hindrances. He says, bhikkhus, suppose a man were to take a loan and undertake business, and his business were to succeed so that he could repay all the money of the old loan, and there remain enough extra to maintain a wife. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. So yeah, it's like, you know, having the five hindrances, it's like you're in debt to somebody. You're not free. There's always pressure, a state of kind of worry, anxiety, agitation. Another way you look at it is, suppose a man were to afflicted, sick, suffering and gravely ill, and his food would not agree with him, and his body had no strength. But later he would recover from the affliction, and his food would agree with him, and his body would regain strength. Then, on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. The same, you know, getting rid of five hindrances, it's like when you're sick, and you're not sick anymore. You're strong, you're healthy. Or suppose the man were imprisoned in a prison house, but later he would be released from prison, safe and secure, with no loss to his property. And then, on considering this, he'll be glad and full of joy. So it's like, you know, out, you know, in prison. We are in prison by our craving and desires. And when we are free from five hindrances, we truly know what freedom is. Okay, it goes on. And it's only by abandoning the five hindrances, imperfection of the mind, the weakened wisdom, then you come to the four jhanas, the deeper states of meditation. And yeah, I don't know, obviously, because I don't read Pali, but this is where possibly you get different interpretation of different absorption states. Here, obviously, in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, he clearly indicates that through all the four jhanas, you can feel the body. Okay. If you say in the first jhana, he makes the rapture and pleasure.
I just listened to Bhikkhu Bodhi talk on that specific subject, some of it.
Ah, okay.
And he said that translation is up to jhana, not during jhana. So when he says pervade the body, he's talking about the four jhanas.
Oh, okay, sorry, okay, so that makes more sense. Okay, so he does, okay. So that's what he says. It says that the Buddha talks about up to the jhana.
Yeah, and then once you enter into jhana, then it's not talking about the body anymore.
But why then, on the different, like the first, second jhana, he's still talking about the body? Because, you know, like, the way other people describe it, so you go through the jhana. So after the body business...
And then he said that in the way that sort of, it seems like you just go 1, 2, 3, 4 like that.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily that there's immediately after each other in that, I mean, that somebody's practicing in that way.
Yeah, I know, but you have to go through them or you just skip from, you know, sitting into straight to second jhana or fourth jhana, because otherwise, yeah. But... anyway, sure. And
they explain that a bit, but it can,
Okay, sure. Yeah, because here, even the fourth jhana, okay? Again, bhikkhus, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, the bhikkhu enters upon abides in the fourth jhana, which is neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. He sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. Just as though a man were sitting covered from head down with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his whole body unpervaded by the white cloth, so too a bhikkhu sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded with a pure, bright mind. I think, like I said, you know, Ajahn Brahm interprets it as the body. It's the body of experience. So it could be talking to, you know, to his the mental aspect of it. That he's actually talking about his mind, pervading his whole mind. But anyway, so after that, so it is a gradual. So then you go to the four jhanas, and only after the four jhanas you have the three true knowledges. There's no, you know, skipping around here. You don't go straight to the true knowledges, you know, the deep understanding, the higher teaching as you hear, some of the other teachers might have indicated. No, you have to have, you know, ethical conduct. And the next, only that, the mind has a chance to settle down. And after that, you have a still mind, deep, you know, you have the jhanas, the deep absorption states. And once you only have a still mind, this wisdom arises. Wisdom doesn't arise from mantra. Wisdom arises from books. Wisdom does not arise from secret teachings that your teacher passed down to you. True wisdom arises from a still mind. And that, having meditated, you know, whatever get peace to you, you feel, it has to be the way. Otherwise, no such thing. Anyway, once your mind is really peaceful, then the true knowledges arise. So when his concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. See, the Buddha talks about past lives. It's not a cultural thing that we add on, that the Buddha add on. It's not, you know, it's not something that, you know, the Thais add on, that the Asians add on. It's something that's in the suttas. So people have said, oh, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, past lives. You know, obviously, I'm not Buddhist. He recollects his many full past lives. There's one birth, two births. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, he recollects the many full past lives. Interesting how the Buddha describes this. Just as a man might go from his own village to another village, and then back again to his own village, he might think, I went from my own village to that village. And there I stood in such a way, sat in such a way, spoke in such a way, kept silent in such a way, and from that village, I went to that other village, and there I stood such a way. Blah, blah, blah. So that's how, yeah, so the first knowledge is your recollection of your own past lives. And I think that's the reason it helps to have a breakthrough through enlightenment, is that if you remember all the things, beings that you've been, man, woman, dog, animal, rich, poor, famous, not famous, infamy, then this delight in existence of coming back starts to fade away. You know, you've done it, you've done everything. So there's nothing, you know, why come back? Why look for another meal? You had 10,000 million meals already. Why look for, you know, another wife when you've had, you know, 2 million of them already? Why look for a partner or whatever? Why want to be something when you remember you've been there and done it? Young, old, sick, and you remember how you die as well. So after, you know, I've done this, you know, a million times, a billion times, then our kind of delight in existence starts to fade very, very quickly when you've been there and done that. After that, next knowledge is the passing away, reappearance of beings. The divine eye. Divine eye works along the same way. You see other beings arising and passing away according to their own karma as well. So you see the law of karma. You know, people come and go. That also helps to have, that's why you have unshakable faith in law of karma. You see how it works. You know, what you do right now carries on to the future. And what you've done in the past carries on to the present moment. And then next, the most important one is the direct knowledge of the destruction of the taints. Right? And understand, as it actually is, this is suffering, origin of suffering, cessation of suffering, Four Noble Truths, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. These are the taints. And what are the different taints? When he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, wanting things, experiencing nice things, the taint of being, you want to be this person, be young, be old, be nice, be bright, be smart, be powerful, and the taint of ignorance, not knowing the three characteristics, not knowing the Four Noble Truths. When it's liberated, there comes the knowledge, you know for sure. It's like, oh, you know, sometimes people say, oh, I think I'm a once returner, but I'm not quite sure. It's like, no, no. You're a stream enterer, you know. The problem is many people think they're stream enterer and they're not, so that could be a problem as well. But generally, there's no doubt. Yes, Roy? If you get in the three knowledges, then you're a fully enlightened being. Yeah, it goes all the way to the end. Yeah. You're an arahant. So he skips. I mean, there's not, you know, the sutras, you know, a lot of times it's just the bare bones, the skeleton of the whole experience. So basically, you know, so the Buddha just went straight from unenlightened being to fully enlightened. After the four jhanas and the three knowledges. And this is the end, the arahant, obviously the fully enlightened one. Bhikkhus, paragraph 22. A bhikkhu such as this is called a recluse, a Brahman, one who has been watched, one who has attained to knowledge, a holy scholar, a noble one, an arahant. See, that's it. So, you know, so he moves, you know, the goal. A recluse is not anyone just wearing the robes or ordaining. You know, that doesn't make you a samana. True recluse is a fully enlightened person. No matter what your robe, the color of the robes are, what you practice are, whether you, you know, male or female, or how many precepts you're keeping. It's not so important. It's the state of the mind, the purity of your mind that counts. And then he defines how, and how is a bhikkhu recluse? He has quieted down evil, unwholesome states that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. That is how a bhikkhu is a recluse. It goes on how a bhikkhu is a Brahman, which is the same thing. How is when being washed, attained to knowledge. Okay, so this is true knowledge, right? True knowledge. So it's not knowledge of how to build a car, not knowledge how to build a house, not knowledge about, you know, the sciences, not a clever person, knowledge about suffering and the end of suffering. You know, so a holy scholar, a true scholar. Right? You don't get scholar from reading different books, translating things. This version, that version, what the Agama said, what the Chinese said, that said. You know, you can write books, but unless you understand truly within yourself what is suffering, what is the end of suffering, you know, there's just more things to let go of. So it's very, very important, obviously, to have a foundation in what the Buddha said and his teaching and how, you know, that kind of like all works. These are just signs. True wisdom arises and still in your mind and seeing in your experience. And where is it that you make suffering for yourself and others? Where and how can you let go of those things? How can you be at peace? So that is a true scholar. How is the bhikkhu a true scholar? The evil unwholesome states that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth and aging and death. He has quieted down those states. That's how he is a true scholar. Noble one, blah, blah, blah. And how is the bhikkhu an arahant? Same thing. Evil, unwholesome states that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen birth, and lead to future birth, aging and death, are far from him. That is how a bhikkhu an arahant. And that is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that's the Asapura Sutta. Questions or comments?
You know how you said that Buddha just went straight to Arahat?
And this said that he described, straight to
Arahat. Yeah, that's
just
the way
it's
described,
right? That's the way it's written, obviously, yeah. But generally, it depends. I think generally the way I understand it from the different meditation masters from Thailand, there are stages, and Buddha does talk about stages, like, you know, stream enterer, sotapanna, once returner, non-returner, and a fully enlightened being. Yeah. But some people do have, you know, the spiritual perfections to, obviously, you know, to finish it all in one go. And it's usually if you, you know, practice many, many lifetimes, you just have that missing ingredient, you have the great, you know, obviously the perfection of being born where the Buddha is. Obviously, he gives you a teaching that's very deep. He knows what your mind is, and then you just crack it. Yeah. Yeah. Good question. I have a vague memory that somewhere in the sutta it says there are two points in your life, most important points in your life. Three. One is, interesting, the Buddha said this. One is you become a novice. Not a monk, you become a novice. That's the most important thing. Yeah. You've gone forth. You become a homeless one, just a novice. And the second one is when you are, the moments you remember, moment is when you are a stream enterer. And next is an arhat. Those are moments that are ingrained in you. And certainly talking with different monks who, you know, kind of reach this point. And that's one of the questions that someone says. That's one of the questions they said. If you think you are a stream enterer, they will ask you, where was it and what time? You should know specifically exactly what you were doing that time, because obviously it's a world shifting, you know, thing. Like it's, you know, huge. It's like an earthquake, you know, tsunami of the mind. It's not like, oh yeah, you know, I'm just, you know, having my lunch or whatever. And, you know, shooting the breeze in the coffee club, and all of a sudden, da-da! No, it doesn't quite work that way. It's quite momentous. And you remember exactly the time, exactly what you were doing at the time. No doubt about it. In any doubt, unlikely. This is unlikely, they said. Yeah, that's my understanding. We're talking to different teachers who've kind of had this experience. But they weren't doing much. Like one was just sweeping, whatever, and seeing impermanence of, you know, kind of the decay of the building or whatever. But it was very, very definite. Yeah. That's what I'm understanding.
The Buddha also said in the suttas that there were some monks who became enlightened.
Yeah.
And they were enlightened.
Were not.
Were. And there were some monks who thought they were enlightened.
That's right.
But they weren't enlightened.
No, that's what I said. That's what I said.
The does say that monks get it wrong.
No, but you can overestimate yourself, but you cannot underestimate. You know, so that's my point was, you certainly can overshoot and think you're enlightened when you're not. That happens a lot. Much more. But you cannot say, you know, that you didn't know you're enlightened. Like walking, oh yeah, I'm enlightened. Oh yeah, I saw so-and-so and he say I'm enlightened. No, that doesn't happen. That you're enlightened, you don't know it. Impossible. Some people are born sotapanna, that's true. Some people are born sotapanna, but they will remember as they work through that. Yeah, so it didn't fluke. Yeah, you're born sotapanna, certainly very pure. Like, you know, Ajahn Tan, you know, kept the five precepts when he was very small. He was like a little kid, decided, you know, he's not going to lie because it was not so nice. Somebody lied to him, he said, you know, I reflect, somebody lied to me, not so nice, so I'm not going to lie. And it was like 4 years old. So certain things carry on, and he was very pure, never, you know, like, you know, yeah. Kept the five precepts and just very pure livelihood. And obviously very strong samadhi. First time he sits down, you know, straight into jhana. And then as he practiced, he remembered. He says, you know, yeah, that's why my practice has been so easy. Because these are the stages I've done already. And then he reached a certain point and he says, okay, this is new. So it took a lot longer. So certain people do get born as a stream enterer. And obviously, you know, there's some speculation that's the same with the Buddha. Who is born a once returner. And that's why when he was born, he stood up and said, you know, I'm the best, the biggest, and you know, I'm going to finish this lifetime. Because obviously something inside him already, you know, kind of programmed. His DNA already, you know, kind of was geared towards enlightenment already. Yeah. Yeah. That's the case. Obviously, you're born in certain stages, you might not know. But it's not like you practice and you don't know that you have reached this certain stage. Yeah, but yeah, like Santu said, certainly you can overestimate. Yeah, certainly the Buddhists, you know, lots of people overestimate. And the Buddha said that, and many monks and nuns attest to that. That lots of people come to them and think they're enlightened for different reasons or whatever, and they're not. Yeah. Yeah, sure. Questions, comments? I just made a small thing with them. Another sutta was good to check on is there on the gradual training in many sutras, but another good one is the Majjhima 29, which is the Maha Sarvapanna Pama Sutta, which is on the hardwood of the tree. So that's really good. I'll just read the last paragraph. Suppose a man needing heartwood. No, not that one. Here, this is one. Okay, here, monks, some clansmen or clanswoman goes forth out of faith from the household life into homelessness, considering I'm a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he has gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is not pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is not fulfilled. When he is diligent, he achieves the attainment of moral discipline. He is pleased with that attainment of moral discipline, but his intention is not fulfilled. When he is diligent, he achieves the attainment of concentration. These are the four jhanas, or at least one jhana. He is pleased with that attainment of concentration, but his intention is not fulfilled. He achieves the knowledge and vision. These are the psychic powers. He is pleased with that knowledge and vision, but his intention is not fulfilled. He does not, on account of it, laud himself and disparage others. He does not become intoxicated with that knowledge and vision. He does not grow negligent and fall into negligence. Being diligent, he attains perpetual emancipation. And it's impossible for that monk to fall away from perpetual liberation. So that's the same thing, you know. And that's interesting. The first thing that comes to you, gain, honor, and renown. You don't have to be very good. You just have to stick around as a monk for a few years. And then people, you know, you get famous, give good talks, write good books, whatever, and then become very famous. And that could be the undone of many monks and nuns. Because you run around and you talk circus and doing this, doing that. Build up this monastery, build up monastery, and you stop practicing. Because you don't have time, obviously, you know, doing things. So then you, so that's the first thing that comes. But then you have to kind of keep your head low, and you work on your other qualities. And next is obviously the ethical conduct, you know, restraint of the senses, purify body, speech, and mind, and then wakefulness, sense restraint. And then after that is concentration. And after concentration, the psychic powers, you don't get too distracted with your psychic powers or whatever, then you have a breakthrough. So it's always a gradual training. One kind of depends on the other. So that's also another way for the gradual training that the Buddha laid down. But there's many, many sutras. Another good book I suggest is the Buddha's Word. This is the anthology on the, you know, kind of, he, Bhikkhu Bodhi went through all the discourses and put in his own gradual training in here. So he cites all of them from the sutras. So then you'll see all the different sutras on the gradual training in this book. And it goes up to, you know, stream enter, wisdom, arahant, so all the sutras, you know, a few main sutras, you know, important sutras regarding what's, you know, an arahant, what they're like, and what's the path reaching to it's like. So that way, otherwise, you know, the sutras you might discover, it's pretty sporadic. It just, you know, jumps everywhere. The Majjhima Nikaya is very good, a lot of it monks and monastics, but the other ones are grouped by topics, and they're grouped by numbers. You know, groups of ones, two, and threes, and it's a bit of a mixed bag. So, if you're, you know, new to the sutras, the Buddha's Word is a very good introduction. Yes? Seeking the hardwood is Sutta 29, Mahasarapanna Sutta. It's a man looking for hardwood. It's a very nice simile as well. He's looking for hardwood. Sometimes he just gets the twigs, he thinks it's hardwood, but it's not hardwood. He goes, you know, sometimes he gets the bark, the trunk, thinks it's hardwood, it's not hardwood. So he's just saying, you know, when you look, you know, the holy life, his goal is, you know, liberation, freedom, not anything else. Not just samadhi, not just psychic powers, not just fame, not just, you know, well known, but, you know, to free yourself from suffering once and for all. That is the goal of the holy life.
Sadhu. Sir.